Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. As you recall, we Zoom on Sunday afternoon, so if something should happen Sunday night, you'll hear about it on Tuesday. This is one of my favorite days. It's our Rethink the Week. But before I introduce our guests, let me start with a bit of political verse by Skip Tenzer. He is our deadline poet. And today's limerick is, how shall we say, a bit edgy. But the last couple of days have been a bit edgy. And Skip writes, hit it with the music, Dave.
Istanbul was Constantinople. Now it's Istanbul, not Constantinople. Been a long time gone. Constantinople, now it's Turkish delight on a moonlit night.
They staged a violent insurrection, encouraged by his constant deception. They did it for, dear leader, their conspiracy breeder, so he could maintain his manly erection.
People just liked it better that way.
So reach me back to Constantinople. No, you can't go back to Constantinople. Been a long time gone. Constantinople, why did Constantinople get the work?
And with that, I have three gentlemen who are joining us. We're all going, oh my God, Artie. Hey, Skip wrote it, not me. I could not let it sit on the table. I just thought it was just too perfect for Donald Trump, who defines himself by his manliness. Joining us for our Rethink the Week are three fabulous guests. We start with Lincoln Mitchell, who we have not ever had on our Rethink the Week, but I have interviewed in the past. He's a political analyst, pundit, and writer based in New York City and San Francisco. He works on democracy and governments-related issues in the former Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, the Caribbean, the Middle East, Africa, and Asia. He also works with businesses and NGOs globally. You speak on U.S. politics, and you actually, I think, do some work at Columbia University. Thank you so much, Lincoln, for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
We also have joining us Stephen Pimpare. He's a nationally recognized expert on poverty, homelessness, and U.S. social policy. He will become a go-to person in the course of the next 4 years because of what has happened over the last 4 years. Prior to joining UNH in 2015, he was teaching courses on American politics and public policy. Where were you teaching before you came to UNH and worked at the Carson
School? I was also in New York. I was at Columbia in the School of Social Work and NYU.
See, we all start at the best place in New
Everybody
York.
Eventually either comes from or goes to New York, is my theory.
Hey, listen, I was born in Bay Ridge. What can I tell you?
Born in the Upper West Side of Manhattan.
That's what I'm saying.
There you go. Now, Dean Spiliotis, I don't know about you. Dean Spiliotis is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. He has a blog, nhpoliticalcapital.com. If you were listening to New Hampshire Public Radio this week, you heard him on Friday. Dean, where were you born?
South Shore of Long Island.
There we go. Close enough.
You know? See?
But there we go. All right. And where are we now? You know, that's the question.
That's right.
There's so much to talk about. What is amazing to me is that last week I was at the height of my happiness and at the low of my unhappiness within a 48-hour period. I was looking at the returns from Georgia, to see a Black African-American, you know, who preaches from one of Martin Luther King's churches, become a member of the U.S. Senate. I see a young Jewish documentarian become a member of the U.S. Senate. And where are they getting elected? But Georgia. I mean, this isn't New York. This isn't California. It's Georgia. The voter turnout was unbelievable. They beat the numbers that Joe Biden won Georgia by 3 and 4 fold. And I'm elated. And then, of course, we see the chaos of January 6th, inspired by our president, who told them in December to come to Washington and went wild. And they did. So I'm looking at all of that. I just can't believe that that's just a couple of days ago. And I decided that I wanted to start with a piece by Jill Lepore from The New Yorker. I just went to The New Yorker before we came on the air, you guys. And I'm going to read a couple of sentences from her headline piece at The New Yorker. What shall we call the 6th of January? All right, that's the title. Big protests in D.C. on January 6th, Donald Trump tweeted before Christmas. Be there, we'll be wild. On New York's day, he tweeted again. The big protest rally in Washington, D.C. will take place at 11 a.m. on January 6th. On January 5th, he writes, I will be speaking at the Save American rally tomorrow on the Ellipse at 11 a.m. Eastern. You better arrive early. Doors are going to open at 7 a.m. Expect big crowds. The posters called it the Save America March. What happened that day was big, and it was wild. If it began as a protest and a rally and a march, it ended as something altogether different. But what? Sedition? Treason? A failed revolution? An attempted coup? And what will it be called looking back? A day of anarchy? The end of America? Trump called the people who violently attacked and briefly seized the US Capitol in order to return a presidential election. Patriots. President-elect Joe Biden called them terrorists. I had to start there. All right, I'm going to start with you, Stephen Pimpare. What do we call what happened on January 6th? And again, just before we come on air and come on Zoom, another Capitol policeman is dead. He committed suicide on Saturday. He was, quote unquote, an off-duty Capitol police, but he showed up anyway on the 6th to protect the U.S. Senate. On Saturday, he killed himself. The Capitol Police are calling it another extension of what happened on the 6th. So, Stephen, as we look at this day, how do we frame it to ourselves now? And how do we package it as we look into the future?
So let me see if I can pull a couple of threads together anyway. Lepore noted that Wednesday's march was the Save America March, right? Which in some ways raises the question, well, save America from what? Or save America for whom? And I think that in some ways, this is the same narrative that Trump has lodged himself in from the start, right? Make America great again. What do we have to make it great for, right? What is it that we have to do, right? What's gone wrong? And of course, what's gone wrong is that since arguably the United States of America was not a democracy in any meaningful sense until 1965 and the enactment of the Voting Rights Act, right? So what we've seen since then is this steady expansion of political and social rights and economic power to all kinds of groups who have been excluded from that throughout the course of our history. Certainly, Black Americans and descendants of slaves, women, other people of color, gays and lesbians and other sexual minorities, right? And with that expansion of power has eroded the dominance of the core of Trump supporters, right? Principally white men who have understood themselves to have a right to govern. You know, I've been trying hard to sort of both think historically, and I think there are some important sort of late 19th century reconstruction into redemption parallels to this moment as well, but I've also been sort of trying hard to think about, well, how do we think about the sort of where we are in historical terms? And maybe there's a way to think of this as a positive development, as horrible as that sounds in this moment, right? Maybe this is not setting us on a path toward a period of extended violence and the resumption of that monopoly power by whites. This is the last throes of a dying movement that is destined to lose its ability to dominate American politics.
Lincoln, I want to believe what Stephen has just suggested. And I think that eventually it may be the death throes, but the next 4 to 10 years, there is going to be some incredible tragedy. They're not going to go willingly. They're armed to the teeth, Lincoln. They don't just have guns. They have ammo depots under their bed. And they have their whiteness to protect them. I mean, again, what we see is the difference between what happened with a Black Lives Matter march and what happened with a Donald Trump Save America march. You know, and not only is it different, but then you begin to raise the question about the complicity of those that are here to protect us. What happened to the Capitol cops? Why were there only maybe 500 instead of the 2,000 or 2,300 cops that belonged to the Capitol Police? Only 500 were assigned that day. They were telling the Pentagon, the Department of Defense, no, we don't need the National Guard. Excuse me? You don't need assistance for what Donald Trump was telling them to go wild? Even as Stephen may be right, I don't know how we survive over the course of the next decade, because I think it is going to be more horrific given the failures we're experiencing from the pandemic and the growing problems from climate change and this. I mean, it's a trifecta of failure.
I don't think you bring me on this show for my optimism, but I tend to agree with much of what you said. One thing to know is that the infiltration, if you will, of our security forces from the United States military, not at the highest levels, but at the mid and lower levels, to your local police force, to the Capitol Police, to the National Guards, to all of these things, by white supremacists, is a real problem, and one that we've never confronted. But all you have to do is attend a Black Lives Matter march, as far as I can see, anywhere, to see that. And what we saw on the Capitol was an example of that. Now, we can speak, obviously, of white privilege here, right? The privilege of the white insurrectionists to do things that people of color simply cannot do, even when peacefully demonstrating. But we also must recognize that they, the Capitol Police, must have known this was coming. Another piece of evidence I would point to is that Sunday or Monday, a number of former defense secretaries of the United States put a piece in the Washington Post warning about violence. Now, these defense secretaries are very accomplished people. Unlike some of us, I assume maybe all of us on this panel, they don't need to place opinion pieces in the Washington Post for their resume, right? They were sending a warning because they have access to intelligence. And the Capitol Police decided to bury this intelligence.
Right.
So where does this put this for the next years? I teach a course called Topics in American Democracy at Columbia, and I've taught it for a number of years. And at the last class of the semester, I end by asking my students not how could the country possibly fall apart in the next 10 years. I ask them, how could the country possibly hold together in the next 10 years? That seems to me to be the more relevant question. The question about the events we saw earlier this week on Wednesday, the 6th, is this the death throes, as Stephen says, which I would like to believe, and it may in fact be true, but death throes can last a while.
Yeah.
Or is it the beginning of something different? My inclination is that it's the latter, and I don't say that with great happiness. Here's a couple of things you can look for in the next few days. I think the most important person in Washington to watch, not because he's particularly smart or decent or has any integrity, but because he's in a hot seat, he's in an interesting place politically, is Kevin McCarthy, the leader of the Republican delegation in the House of Representatives. 138 of his members voted, even after hearing, after all this, to buy into the disinformation campaign that the election had been stolen. What that tells you is that the House of Representatives, which is a quicker, better measure of the state of the party than, say, the Senate, because of the way that the system works, there is still a consensus that this election was stolen among the people there. We know from the data we've seen now, which sounds about right, is that 45% of the Republican Party support the insurrectionist. I would ask our listeners to just think about this, and my fellow panelists, think about this in your own head. You don't have to give an answer, but a month from now, do you expect that number to be closer to 35%, in which case we're trending in the right direction, or for 55%, in which case we are really in for a long and possibly violent struggle? My sense is it's going to be closer to 55% as the Republicans begin to retell the story. So I am very concerned in the short and medium term for the stability of the country, for precluding real violence, and for the future of American democracy.
And the reason why you're so concerned about the House of Representatives, and Dean, we know this, congressmen run every 2 years. That means they're on a short leash. And for the next 2 years, who's going to basically own the leash is Donald Trump. I don't see him not owning it. Maybe not 4 years out, maybe not, but for the next 2 years, he will basically own the leash.
And these people like Donald Trump legitimately.
And not only do they like him, but Dean, I'm listening to a report on CNN, and some reporter was down in Florida, and all these Floridian Republicans are saying, oh, it was so terrible, oh, it was so terrible. But would you vote for Donald Trump again in 4 years? Yes. Why? Do you know why, Dean? Because he's good for their wallets. See, it's not about democracy. It's not about killing people. It's not about disorder. They figure that they can build a moat around where they live because they have their wealth. They can order their private police because they have their wealth. Donald Trump will ensure that their portfolios expand. And in the end, the thing that they value most is what Donald Trump produces, money for their next of kin or whatever. It is so incredibly selfish, but it's not surprising. And those Republicans in the House of Representatives, they know what Donald Trump is able to do, and they also know what their base wants. And what their base wants is for them to genuflect to Trump.
We very quickly honed in on two of the biggest questions that I've been discussing with people over the last few days as we sort through all of this, and I'm going to add a third one in a moment. But the first question, as Steve suggested, is the question of whether or not this is the death throes of something or the beginning of something new. And the other question, as we were just discussing it and we're talking about now, is what is going to be President Trump's relative strength as an ex-president? Is his political capital going to remain high, or is it going to decline precipitously once he's out of office? Just how much damage has he done to himself as a potential leader in the future? Those really are two of the big questions. The third one that I've actually increasingly been spending time talking about with people who get in touch with me, it really has come to dominate everything very quickly, is the issue of social media and the role of social media in all of this. The founders were obsessed with the idea that passions not be allowed to overtake reason. And in fact, Madison writes in Federalist 10 about the fact that, you know, the pluralistic nature of society, the geographical expanse of the United States at that time, which was basically just the East Coast, that it was sufficiently large and complex that like-minded individuals would not be able to find each other and, quote, execute their plans of oppression. Well, the internet allows everybody to find like-minded individuals instantaneously. My conversations with people and other analysts and reporters, et cetera, has very quickly switched from talking about white supremacy and kind of the existential threat and anxiety a lot of the people we saw in the Capitol are experiencing in a more multicultural society. It's very quickly changed to primarily talking about the role of tech companies and their ability to restrict access to an essential communications platform. And the founders wanted to insulate our institutions from this kind of volatility. They were more concerned about Congress than the president. And President Trump has turned out to be probably the most effective user of social media of all in terms of inciting volatility. So we really, I think we've hit on, those are three of the main things that I've been talking about over the last couple of days.
Speaking of social media, Twitter says you're banned for life. Parler, you can't get this app. I mean, we're seeing like all these doors slamming. People keep saying, oh, the Trump people and the Trump children, this is free speech. This is free speech. No, honey. It's called a company. And the company decides what speech you have. They can open the door. They can shut the door. They can pull the plug. They can put in the plug. And right now they're pulling the plug. And suddenly they're realizing the difference between when it's corporate ownership and they're the gatekeeper versus, frankly, when it's the government and they're the gatekeeper. I mean, it's a completely different thing. Let me just say something about the social media thing that Dean just said, Stephen. And that is that what I realize about social media and its instant gratification is that it accelerates and enhances emotion. I can be angry and write a letter. Very different. I can be angry and even call a friend and still very different. Or I can be angry and go on Facebook and Twitter. What happens is not only do I get to express my emotion, but then I'm bombarded with thousands of people that respond to me immediately. And that just heightens my emotion. The whole thing with social media is like a whirling dervish. Even the fact that our whirling dervish, as Dean was talking about, Stephen, is now armed and ready to take down the government. I'm just trying to figure out how you undo it. I mean, I understand Twitter and I understand what Facebook is doing. If there's a version of Twitter like Parler or whatever that can come up and create their own source, do we stop them from finding each other even though they're not on my social media platform? They just have their own social media platform.
Let me just say real quick and then I'll turn it over to Stephen. Hamilton, this is why he wanted the Electoral College to vote in state capitals. He didn't want everybody getting together in one place. They thought that would be a recipe for chaos. Keep everybody separate. Social media has completely undercut Hamilton and Madison on this issue of pluralistic society and people not being able to find each other. And as you said, it's all about emotion and passion and the ability to amplify that and be manipulated by politicians like Trump, for example.
So, Stephen, now what do we do?
One of the concerns that resides in the structure of the Constitution, large numbers of people getting together and acting antagonistically toward the people with wealth and power who were the constructors of that Constitution to begin with, right? And so the flip side of talking about the potential dangers of social media is to think about the ways in which social movement actors in the United States and in even more repressive regimes has been able to use that as a tool for organization, for mobilization. It has made available access to knowledge, information, connections to people who don't reside in concentrated places. The question for me is, How do you, I mean, you know, you're not going to put this genie back in the bottle. Mm-hmm. We decide that we're going to have that long promised nuclear war and simply destroy our ability to have electronic communication, which I would like to think we will not do. Absent that, we're not going to put the genie back in the bottle. So the question then becomes, how do we understand using democratic state power to maximize opportunity for positive uses of those resources and minimize the opportunities for that to cause damage and harm both to individuals, communities, and to the nation at large? And I don't pretend to have an answer to that question.
So, Lincoln, I was on the air last week and I kept saying that, I think it was when the Association of Manufacturers, someone sent it to me literally 30 seconds after they actually either put it out or put it out in a press release and said, "Do you see this?" And we know that they're fairly Republican-ish leaning group. And for them to call for the 25th Amendment was pretty amazing. And I have been saying actually before that, where's the Chamber of Commerce? Where is Big Pharma? Where is, frankly, big oil, coal, and gas? Because in the end, they need stability. They need a stable country in order to make their vast profits. And so then I saw this group come out. What I think is so interesting is, once again, we're looking not to government to figure out how to tap the instability down and to fix it. We're looking at big business. You saw big business in Texas with the bathroom bill when they tried to get the transgender bathroom bill through in Texas, and big business said, "You think you're going to pass this? We're going to move." And now you're seeing what's happening here. And we're seeing it with Twitter, and we're seeing it with Facebook, and we're seeing it with Google. And I'm wondering, is government necessary anymore? Is it going to be big tech and big business that basically ends up establishing the parameters or how we're to behave?
Government, I believe, is certainly necessary. The way I might look at that question is, does government have the power anymore, right? And for me, one of the things that's really striking here is that you're absolutely right. Facebook and Twitter are private companies, just like the New York Times is. The New York Times can decide that they want to print Tom Cotton's opinion piece, or they can print someone else's. They certainly have a lot of good people sending in opinion pieces every day. Twitter and Facebook work a little differently, right? Because it's an open platform in that regard. One of the things that strikes me here is that you see both with the National Association of Manufacturers, with Twitter, with other businesses, and also with not private sector, but not-for-profits like universities, that the culture has moved so far beyond this kind of angry, right-wing, Trump MAGA white cult. Because, for example, if you have a hate speech policy that you do not allow hate speech on your platform, which I think is something we could all objectively agree with, right? We don't want people tweeting, I don't know, that some racial groups are subhuman or that the Jews control the media, right? Those are kind of white supremacist ideology. But when you have a party that is dominated by white supremacists and that is their ideology, what do, right? So to go back a little bit into what's now ancient history, Donald Trump's 2016, the closing commercial in that campaign could have been lifted from the protocols of the Elders of Zion. It was a flat out anti-Semitic commercial. But what does Twitter do, right? Do they say, because every Republican signed off on that, didn't say a word. So if you're going to start blocking white supremacists and people who engage in hate speech, Donald Trump is a small part of your problem. You got to go after Don Jr., the South Carolina Republican Party, because of some of the tweets they made about Jamie in that campaign. It goes on and on and on. That's an imperfect situation, because ultimately they're either going to do that or not. But that's why you need some kind of government action here, some kind of policies, some kind of regulation. I don't know quite what that looks like, but for government to walk away and say, this isn't our problem. And I would say that clearly, I mean, I've worked on democracy issues around the world. I know how this can connect people that otherwise can't be connected, but I also know how it can mobilize people to commit acts of violence all over the world that they wouldn't otherwise commit in places like Myanmar, in places like India. So this is a very, very tough question, and it would be good if we had people at the government level engaging with it who, I don't know, knew the difference between Facebook and Twitter, knew what an algorithm was, knew how the algorithms work. So there's this real gap. Frankly, you look at some of the people coming in, I'm a little hopeful that a guy like John Ossoff, who probably grew up around the internet, is going to be a little better on this than, I don't know, Chuck Grassley or somebody, not to be ageist at all, because some of the older people are very good on this. But it's a real problem. It's not going to go away, and we cannot hope that the private sector, who is in the business of driving down wages, of creating some of the problems that get us down this road, saves us.
Okay, so Dean, we're going to have to end this half hour, but I want to just sort of read something. There was a Colorado congresswoman. Now, so we're talking about people outside. I want to talk a little bit about Cruz and Hawley and the 138 or however many number that continued to vote to basically just throw out the Electoral College results. This congresswoman from Colorado is a gun extremist, a QAnon supporter. She tweeted this declaration of war on the day of the Capitol riots, and it's still up. And this is what Boebert's tweet was. This is 1776. That's what she tweeted on January 6th. Wait a minute, it gets worse. She also live tweeted the locations of her congressional colleagues, including the Speaker of the House, further exposing them to harm. So as they are storming the steps of the Congress, she is live tweeting where everybody is. And she tweeted out the exact location of Nancy Pelosi at 1:18. The attack began at 1:15. All right, this is when she tweeted out. And last but not least, she put out a slick video on Twitter several days prior to the event, showing herself walking around the Capitol Hill carrying a gun and suggesting, Dean, that others should do so as well. So now we're talking about what should we do? And I am looking at some U.S. senators and asking the question, what do we do with them? And I'm looking at people like Congresswoman, the newly elected Congresswoman Lauren Boebert, and the other 138 members of Congress. What do we do with them, Dean?
In terms of censure or removal?
What do you do with them? They're inside the halls of Congress. Yeah. They're telling people with guns exactly where Nancy Pelosi is.
No, it's clear from listening to people over the last few days that some number of these individuals really believe that this is like the American Revolution. That's why they call themselves patriots. They really believe that this armed insurrection is the way that they save the country, as misguided as that may be. And the debate we're going to have now is, do we just move on, as some Republicans want to do? Or do you have to have some kind of reckoning before you can move on? That's the debate we're hearing right now. It's starting to sound a little predictable. Maybe that'll change in the next week.
All right, we need to go to a break. This is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We'll be right back.
Insight Daily Radio.
From food to fashion, science to tech talk, or for just plain fun, we've got you covered. From the art of all things, here's Lasana Jeffries.
With the holidays approaching and the celebrating escalating, I think we should take a moment to talk about imbibing responsibly. Alcohol is a factor in 60% of fatal burn injuries, drownings, and homicides, 50% of severe trauma injuries and sexual assaults, and 40% of fatal motor vehicle crashes, suicides, and fatal falls. At blood alcohol 0.02, drinkers begin to feel moderate effects. At 0.04, most people begin to feel relaxed, mildly euphoric, sociable, and talkative. At 0.05, judgment, attention, and control are somewhat impaired. Ability to drive safely begins to be limited. At 0.08, this is the legal level for intoxication in some states. There is a definite impairment of muscle coordination and driving skills. 0.1, this is legally drunk in most states. There is a clear deterioration of reaction time and control. 0.12 to 0.14, vomiting usually occurs unless this level is reached slowly or a person has developed a tolerance to alcohol. Drinkers display emotional instability, loss of critical judgment, impairment of perception, memory, and comprehension. When you reach 0.18 to 0.25, drinkers are disoriented, confused, dizzy, and have exaggerated emotional states. Death may occur at 0.37% or higher, and at 0.45%, this is fatal to nearly everyone. So be safe, and thanks for listening. I'm Lisanna Jeffries.
Insight Daily Radio.
Step stand up. We shall not be moved, except by a child with no socks and shoes. If you got more to give, then you've got to prove. Put your hands up, and I'll copy you. Stand up. We shall not be moved, except by a woman dying from a loss of food. If you've got more to give, then you've got to prove. Put your hands up, and I'll copy you. We still don't understand. Thunder and lightning flash back to when we didn't fund the dam. Didn't fund the dam levy? No wonder, man. Now a whole damn city's torn asunder, man. Underwater, but we still don't understand. We see hurricane spills overrun the land through gaps you couldn't fill with 100 tons of sand. No, we still don't understand. We've seen planes in the windows of buildings crumbled in. We've seen flames sending chills through London, and we've set planes to kill them, and some of them are children, but still we crumble in the building. Underfunded, but we still don't understand. Under God, but we kill like the son of Sam. But if you feel like I feel about the son of man, we will overcome. So stand up. We shall not be moved, except by a child with no socks and shoes. If you've got more to give, then you've got to prove. Put your hands up, and I'll copy you. Stand up. We shall not be moved, except by a woman dying from a loss of food. If you've got more to give, then you've got to prove. Put your hands up, and I'll copy you. I said put your hands up, and I'll copy you. Put your hands up, and I'll copy you. If you've got more to give, then you've got to prove. Put your hands up, and I'll copy you. We shall not be moved, except by a child with no socks and shoes, except by a woman dying from a loss of food, except by a freedom fighter bleeding on a cross for you. We shall not be moved, except by a system that's rotten through, neglecting the victims and ordering the cops to shoot. High treason, now we need to prosecute. So stand up. We shall not be moved, and we won't fight a war for a fossil fuel. Of times like this, make you wanna plot a coup. Put your hands up, and I'll copy you. Stand up. We shall not be moved, unless we're taking a route we have not pursued. So if you've got a dream and a lot to do, put your hands up, and I'll copy you. I said put your hands up, and I'll copy you. Put your hands up, and I'll copy you. If you've got a dream and a lot to do, put your hands up.
Welcome back to part two of the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We continue our conversation with three fabulous guests. We have Lincoln Mitchell, who is a writer, a pundit, teaches at Columbia, writes about everything, and we've met him before, and we're so glad that he's part of our panel. Dean Spiliotis is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar from Southern New Hampshire University, and Stephen Pimper is a nationally recognized expert on poverty, homelessness, and U.S. social policy, teaches at UNH Manchester, as well as a senior fellow at the Carsey Institute. Incredibly smart, incredibly articulate individuals, and Dean, we sort of left with giving you sort of a bit of short shrift. As we look at the chaos of the last week, of course, the question then becomes, actions should have consequences, all right? Now the question is, what are those consequences? And we've heard three things. He should resign. Yeah, right. Then the other one is, you know, the 25th Amendment. Really? Who's going to call for it? You know, obviously, Vice President Pence says, I'm not going to do it. And then, of course, they're talking about the idea that once again, we should look at whether we should impeach him for the second time, which means he'll be the first president ever in U.S. history to be impeached twice. But we know that time is of the essence, and how far will they get, and what happens with the U.S. Senate, yada, yada, yada. So as we look at this, if nothing else, the idea of impeachment seems very real. It seems like they'll move ahead with it next week, even though it may not come to fruition, even though they may not be able to remove him. Is there value for the U.S. Congress to begin to embrace this concept of impeachment, knowing that the result they want, which is for him to be removed, will not happen via impeachment? It'll happen because on January 20th, Joe Biden will be the next president of the United States. So what's your thoughts on this impeachment move?
He would be out of office before he could actually have a Senate trial. You know, there's some discussion and debate now about whether or not, I'm not a lawyer, but a constitutional scholar, legally speaking, but there's some debate over whether or not you can even have a Senate trial after a president is out of office. And, you know, some suggest there'd have to be a separate vote in order to ban him from ever running for office again. But I think it raises a larger issue. And this is something that Bernie Sanders said a few days ago, and I think he was right. Sometimes I'm a critic of Bernie, sometimes I agree with him. But in this case, I agree with him. And he said that, putting aside the issue that he's going to be gone in a week, simply saying, we don't want to do any more because people are going to get more upset, let's just like move on, sets a terrible precedent for future presidents, future members of Congress. The more we learn about this, I keep watching more and more footage of what actually happened. Now that it's getting, I mean, it's shocking to me, this isn't simply a rowdy group of protesters. I mean, this was violent. It may not have been violent for everyone, but it was violent for a pretty significant number of individuals. The pattern of incitement in not only President Trump, but Ted Cruz, Josh Hawley, Mo Brooks from Alabama, Rudy Giuliani, who's not a member of Congress, but nonetheless talking about the need for combat. The more I think about this, the more I see the reality of what has happened here. To do nothing, even if it's after the fact, I think is just a mistake. There has to be some kind of reckoning here that will deter people from doing this again in the future. I mean, it really is almost shocking to me to see Republicans, many of them very quickly slip back into the kind of standard Democrats against Republicans. And, you know, I'm waiting for somebody to attack Hillary Clinton or start talking about Hunter Biden again, or the whataboutism is creeping back in very quickly. And I think that's a huge mistake. I don't always agree with Bernie, but I do in this circumstance.
Well, actions do have to have consequences. And I think part of the consequence is not necessarily the removal, because that will happen on January 20th, but it is the vote on impeachment. And you will have people on the record in the House, either voting for it or voting against it. Stephen, I'm going to take this personally. Remember the case of Texas v. Johnson, the flag burning case? Remember that back in the 80s? That flag burning case happened while I was a young legislator. And my legislature decided to have a proclamation condemning the United States Supreme Court. And I went up to the clerk and I said, I am going to fight the proclamation. And my clerk was like, please, Arnie, they'll crucify you. Please, Arnie, they'll crucify you. I said, no, I will crucify myself if I don't speak out against that proclamation. All right. And of the 400 members, I think we only got 66 votes. But you know what? That was the proudest vote I ever took. And when people challenge me later, I mean, it's to me, it's just amazing. There are some times you need to speak out. You need to be on the record, whether you accomplish something or not. It is important. And I think it's really important, like Bernie says, that there are consequences. And some of those consequences are the fact that you want them on the record, basically saying that they embrace what Donald Trump instigated, which was this horrific insurrection. I think it's important to say this is not acceptable. Stephen?
There are other kinds of more practical consequences we should be thinking about as well. One is that a former president can, in fact, be impeached and convicted in a Senate trial. And my understanding is also, as Dean said, that there would be then a separate vote to forbid that individual from holding any public office ever again in the United States, which I think is not a trivial consideration. I also think we need to be considering that by statute, there are a number of benefits that accrue to former presidents. Secret Service detail, you get a travel allowance, but you also are entitled to national security briefings. Given what we know about Trump and the world, the legal world and the financial world that he is entering into once he leaves office, tell me you think that it is inconceivable that a foreign government approaches him and says, tell you what we're going to do. We will wipe out your whatever it is, $200, $300 million debt to Deutsche Bank if you will share with us the following information that you are receiving as part of your regular national security briefings, right? We have to ensure that he does not have any more access to sensitive information than he currently has. One other point I would make. This is slightly more extreme comparison, but I think an apt one. If you think of the denazification regime that Germany underwent at the end of World War II, and even before the coup attempt, the ongoing coup attempt, arguably since November, but the sort of its violent turn, there have been people talking about sort of something along the lines of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, right? That we really do sort of think about in a very deep way, unearthing the institutionalized white supremacists in government and without, and look for ways to limit their ability to do harm, including members of Congress. And I think we need to be thinking about as well, starting with expelling them from the body.
What scares me, Lincoln, is that when I go back to the Confederacy and I go back to Nazi Germany, the Confederacy, the South knew they lost. Nazi Germany knew they lost. The problem right now is we have 700 plus million people or 70 million people who don't think they lost. They think it was stolen. That it makes it very, very hard to have this truth and reconciliation. The premise will be a winner and a loser, of which 70 plus million or at least 50 million don't necessarily believe that. And that's part of what makes this such a challenge for Biden and for whoever goes forward, given what they're assuming and they've been fed and they truly, truly believe that this was a theft of their democratic institutions.
Even if they believe they lost, which I don't know that they do, but even if they do, there are still 74 million people in America who looked around in late October and early November before all of this and said, you know what, things are all right. Let's give this guy another four more years. And the overwhelming majority of those people would do the same thing tomorrow. And that makes any kind of attempt at transitional justice both extremely difficult, because there is no consensus that this was a regime that sought to roll back American democracy. But it also makes it extremely important. The media has told us over and over that we can either move forward or look back and arrest and indict and investigate. The truth is, we can only move forward if we restore rule of law, and we can only restore rule of law if there are consequences. Now, my sense is, you know what the consequence is going to be for Mo Brooks? Re-election. That is where the Republican Party, this is still Donald Trump's Republican Party. This is still a party. I mean, I just saw an Ipsos poll during the break that is still pretty solidly behind Trump and behind these lies. But I just want to raise one other point about impeachment, because on balance, I'm for it. But I do want to raise a couple points. I think I'm for banning Trump from ever seeking office again, because I believe he is a threat to our national security. But if a Democratic majority in the Senate, with some Republicans on board, vote that way, they are taking a problem off of the Republican Party's hands. The work of the Republican Party has to be to de-Trumpify their party. And if we forbid Trump from running for office again, we're doing half that work for them. The other point I would raise about impeachment, because I would like to see Donald Trump out of office tomorrow. It's not going to happen, but for a number of reasons, one of which, he is an ongoing threat to national security. And if you don't believe that, roll the tape from January 6th. But a problem with impeaching Donald Trump is that it brings a false sense of closure. There are, as both Stephen and Dean pointed out, a lot of high-ranking Republicans in the administration, in the Congress, at the state level, who are responsible for this, who played a role in this. They need to be held accountable as well. But I also want to raise one last point. On January 6th, Mitch McConnell gave a speech which was widely lauded for, you know, standing up and saying it's not, you know, he lost badly, he wasn't close, let's certify this. But you know when Mitch McConnell began to recognize the election was over? After the Electoral College voted. All of these Republicans, every single one of them is complicit in this. And it doesn't matter if late on the day of January 6th, you realized, oh, things are going pretty badly. If you resigned on January 6th, you are either just trying to cover your you-know-what, or you are, in plain English, too stupid to be in government.
I understand you don't want to get the problem of Donald Trump off the Republicans' back. You want them to have to deal with the rot that has now defined them. And the only way to cut out the cancer is that they have to cut out the cancer. They can't expect the other party to cut out the cancer, because then a variation on that cancer is going to reemerge. I mean, let's be honest, that rot has really not been drained out. And yet, as I'm looking going forward, not only is Donald Trump incredibly powerful, even in the last couple of days, but he's actually got some additional power, not just from social media, but in an interesting bit of perpetuity. And that is, Stephen, is that he has the power of pardons. And I am looking at all the people that are being rounded up. They're going to look at the police that were actually there from Seattle and the cop that was there from New Hampshire. And they're going to sort of collect people, and there are going to be consequences to all these horrific things that took place, because they've got lots of video and they got a lot of Facebook time. So I asked the question on my Facebook page, could he give a blanket pardon to everyone that participated in the events of January 6th? And basically all those quote unquote consequences would disappear for those people. And once again, Donald Trump would reinforce why he is such a cult figure and why he is beloved, because not only was he able to deliver the country they think they want, but he was able to protect them and give them immunity from any consequences for their actions. So therefore, that cult figure becomes even more important to their future. Stephen?
Another reason to remove him from office as soon as practical, but I'm in agreement, I think. Absent something even more horrific emerging in our knowledge of what happened this past week, and that doesn't seem impossible, or him engaging in some new horrible and dangerous behavior. You know, as with the question of whether he is able to pardon himself, the answer seems to be, well, we don't know because we do not have precedent for these kinds of questions, right? We don't have a body of experience and a body of law that we can look back on and say, well, in analogous cases, this is what we have seen and how this has played out. Could he issue a blanket pardon to everyone who was in a 2-mile radius of the Capitol and had potentially committed or been charged with a crime? I mean, he could do that. What would then happen, what the response would be, I think then brings us back to, are there enough people in various positions of authority and power to take the threat that we have confronted and continue to confront seriously enough to fight aggressively against that kind of use of executive power?
He's already talking about preemptive pardons with himself, his children. I mean, wait a minute, if it's good for the Trump family, why isn't it good for the people that assaulted Congress on January 6th? What are they charged with? We don't know. What's Donald Trump charged with? We don't know. I described Donald Trump didn't ever care about vaccinations when it came to COVID, but he does care about these preemptive pardons because they're like his vaccine, okay? And they're the only vaccines that he wants in people's arms. He wants them in the arms of his cronies. He wants them in the arms of his children. And frankly, he wants them in the arms of the insurrectionists. That's the vaccine he wants, not the one that deals with COVID-19. And that's why, as I look at this, I think it can be challenged, like Stephen said, but where would you go to challenge it? The United States Supreme Court. What are the boys and girls on the court going to do with that 6-3 conservative majority? How are they going to interpret whether he has the authority to do this, since this is basically an untested concept?
It's not entirely untested, because when Carter pardoned the people who evaded the draft, I don't believe he named them.
He didn't.
So there is a precedent for blanket pardons. And the pardon clause in the Constitution is pretty strong. You don't have to give a reason. You don't have to do anything. And the court is pretty weighted in favor of Donald Trump right now. This does underscore, as Stephen points out, the need to get that impeachment done quickly and the ongoing danger he could do. Because let's be clear here, you refer to it as kind of a political vaccination. What he is also doing is empowering terrorists who sought to overthrow the democratic processes of the American government to do it again. That is the meaning of a pardon.
Dean, as you hear what Lincoln just said, again, that's why I want impeachment. That's why I want the record. And as you're saying, Dean, the more and more we see of what actually happened in Congress, it's horrifying. It is horrifying what they wanted to do. They wanted to hang Vice President Pence. I mean, let's be honest, that's what they were chanting. And I think they even put up a noose somewhere.
They had fully functioning gallows in addition to automatic weapons and bombs.
I know. What I am thinking is, if we can get people on the record, basically covering Trump's butt on this, the fact that he's inciting this kind of insurrection, that even if these are conservative, you know, Congress people, those tapes and that vote will be run during a primary. Those tapes and that vote will be run during the general election. And let's be honest, they may be able to have a gerrymandered congressional district, but you can't gerrymander a state. So for the U.S. senators, it is problematic. That's what we saw in Georgia. It should be a Republican state, but it's not anymore because of the changing demographic. And yeah, there are congressional districts that are uber conservative, but when you look at the gestalt of a state, guess what? You can change an election and change the turnout.
It's why Mitch McConnell didn't want to entertain the challenges to electoral votes because he didn't want people to have to go on record one way or the other. The pardoning stuff at this point, it's so, again, this is one of those areas where I say, well, I'm not a lawyer, but it's so opaque to me how this would actually work. The idea of a preemptive pardon, and can Trump even pardon himself? I mean, at this point, I'm just interested to see what a Supreme Court would say about that. It sounds like it's going to be a pardon palooza, as they say. He's going to try to pardon his entire family and all his associates, and we'll see if he tries some kind of a blanket pardon on the people who were involved in the assault in the Capitol. That would be a remarkable thing to see how that plays out. But at this point, with can a president pardon himself? I don't hold out high hopes, but I'd be interested to see what the Supreme Court says.
Well, he loves to pardon murderers. Look what he did with the Blackwater folks. There is no end to what he has the capacity to do. I said this the other day. Donald Trump is not dishonest. Donald Trump is ahonest, Stephen Pimpare. He doesn't even have the capacity. There's no guilt. There's no empathy. See, if you're dishonest, you kind of know what honest is because you're being dishonest. When you are ahonest, there is no difference, all right? It's whatever you think. That's what you define. And that's what so scares me about this. We haven't even gotten to the really huge story. And the huge story is how we are failing on COVID-19. And I mean failing. The world can't believe that this rich, rich country with the most expensive healthcare system in the world that's oozing with its big pharma is incapable of getting out vaccines, is incapable of tapping down on this COVID-19. And on top of which, I want to sort of tie in the conversation we have just been having, the New Republic headline. The actual death toll from the pro-Trump riot won't be known for weeks. Many who stormed the Capitol in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic did not wear masks. Then they went back to DC hotels and shops, and then they went home. And now we know that this is an even more contagious version of COVID-19. So guess what? It's not just who they killed in DC. It's who they're going to bring home and kill, let alone themselves, their family, and their community. This, again, is another situation where it is so appalling. The question then becomes, not only what does Joe Biden do, but does it make us recognize that this wealth and this money we have spent on healthcare has actually been an incredible failure?
Well, I mean, I think you would find widespread agreement that the way in which we organize healthcare and healthcare delivery in the United States is and has been an abject failure for most of the last century, right? I don't think that's open to dispute to pay attention to health policy. There's a more sort of troubling implication of what has largely been a Republican failure to take COVID seriously, keeping in mind that New York has not done a particularly good job. There are Democratic places that have not done well on this either. But you've got this sort of deep desire to pretend that we are not in the midst of a pandemic, not just from Trump, but from other national Republicans. And I think part of what's at stake there is that a pandemic is not something that the market can solve, right? We've got these decades of ideology, right, rooted in this notion that government is never the solution, government is always the problem, right? Get government out of the way and the private sector, the market will step in and everything will be magic. Well, this is one instance in which, no, there is no earthly way in which you can make this problem better without centering a strong, competent, well-resourced government. And we're seeing the consequences.
So I'm going to end with you, Mr. Mitchell. I so want Joe Biden to message exactly what Stephen Pimpare said. If he's going to send out $2,000 checks, I want him to take a page out of Donald Trump, and I want him to sign the freaking $2,000 check. If he's going to bail out small business, I think he wants to be there when he hands them a check or saves their employees or saves their restaurant. I want those ads everywhere. And I want it to be Biden government, Biden government, Biden government. What saved you wasn't Google. What saved you wasn't Amazon. What saved you wasn't Twitter. It was good, effective government. My biggest problem with my party, Lincoln, is my party loves what the Republicans have been doing for years. The Republicans' answer to everything, Lincoln, is no. No government, no regulation, no taxes. And guess what? You don't have to explain no. It ends the conversation. We are technically about yes. Yes, some government. Yes, some regulation. Yes, some taxes. But we're afraid of that. So we haven't even been able to articulate it because we're so jealous of Republicans who get to end the conversation with no. Is Biden, does he have the capacity not only to begin to figure out how to solve it, but to have people understand that it was government that was part of the solution and critical to the solution?
Well, The United States really catastrophic response to COVID-19, and with a president, this current president, deliberately murderously catastrophic response to COVID-19, is a failure of public health, obviously. But as you point out, it's also a failure of governance.
Yes.
And the reason our governance, and again, at the state and local level in many cases, not all cases, as well as the national level, but the reason for that failure is precisely what you've identified, a propaganda campaign from the right into which too many in the Democratic Party bought, saying that government can't solve problems, as Stephen always says, the market always will. What this COVID episode, leaving aside all of the politics we've been discussing, you know, through most of the show, is evidence that our model is wrong. The propaganda we've been telling ourselves since Ronald Reagan first began his campaign for president has always been wrong. But if you don't see that now, then you're really in bad shape. And the challenge for a new President Biden is not just to get the message across that government is going to how we're going to solve this problem, because you're right about that, but also to begin to think a little bit bigger and to begin to think in the 21st century, with radically increasing wealth disparity, with a problem of deep racism that goes to the core of this country since before it was founded. The only way we get over those two problems, which lead to so many others in our society, is by thinking about a larger and more progressive role for government. You can't get elected on that promise, but you can't save America any other way.
All right, everyone. This is this Monday edition of Attitude with Arnie Arneson and, of course, Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott. We will schmooze tomorrow. Stay safe. You better-